Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, May 29, 2017. A prominent South Sudanese politician is asking the South Sudan army to stop fighting, calling it a senseless war.
I'm appealing to the SPLA soldiers not to fight one another, to come back for peace and leave this senseless war of President Samper, because it's just to protect himself and Kakun himself in day one.
And on this World Peacekeepers Day, an official with the UN mission in South Sudan is calling for accountability.
I appeal to everybody, whether in government or in opposition, in civil society, to make a real effort in reconciling and healing.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A prominent South Sudanese politician is calling on South Sudan army soldiers to stop fighting across the country. Rebecca Nyandeng says the conflict in South Sudan has affected half of the country's population. Nyandeng says the problem is government soldiers are not being paid and their families are suffering during this economic crisis. She says the ongoing fighting across the country benefits one person in particular, President Salva Kiir.
They are fighting each other, South Sudanese. They are killing one another. Nobody is paying attention to them. They are not being paid salaries, and people forget about them. And the whole money goes to J1. Nobody pay attention, and they are killing the front line. Nobody pay attention to them. So why are they fighting each other? For who? So I'm appealing to the SPLA soldiers not to fight one another, to come back for peace and leave this senseless war of President Samper, because it's just to protect himself and Kakun himself in day one.
Government supporters, or the government, would even say that they are protecting the national integrity and the national security of the country, because according to them, Riek Machar has taken up arms to fight the government, and there are other actors who have taken up arms to fight the government. They would say they are protecting the integrity of South Sudan.
The integrity of South Sudan is being threatened by who? Nobody. For me, as far as I'm concerned, nobody. Because if you could see, and you could agree with me, this is senseless war. When people agreed in Addis in 2015, what brought the war back in July 2016? For what? Does any fight in Wau-Shuluk and in Kodok, does it have any sovereignty protection? Killing people in Yei, and these are your own people. And the soldiers are dying, the people of South Sudan are dying, and the famine is looming, killing the people. If the only place which is not on the red dot is only Juba. So please, I'm appealing to the SPLA so that they can open the access for humanitarian to go to their people, and people come back to peace. If they put down their arms now, Salva will not be able to stay in power. He will be able either to negotiate or leave power to people of South Sudan.
The foot soldiers get their orders from the commanders, and the commanders get their orders from the commander-in-chief or even the chief of the army. Are you appealing to the foot soldiers, or are you appealing to the commanders or the commander-in-chief of the army?
The commanders are not fighting any war. It is the soldiers who are fighting the war. And if the commanders are giving orders and they don't have food that they are giving to the army, and they don't have salaries that they are giving to the army, and people are dying in the front, those who are carrying guns, they are parents of children, and they have their wives. Some of them are just dying for nothing. And I don't see why people are fighting this war. Where is the oil? Where is the money of oil of South Sudan? Where does it go to? And now we are appealing to international community for humanitarian relief. South Sudan should have not been hungry at all.
What is going to be the solution to this political crisis in South Sudan? If you are speaking like that, what is going to be the solution?
The solution is for the soldiers not to fight. They should not be fighting their own people. They should demand for peace. People should demand for peace, because those soldiers are being turned against their own people. Now you find the 64 tribes of South Sudan at each other's throat, and these things are being created by the government of Juba. And not even Juba, but the government in J1.
President Kiir has asked people who are disgruntled to come for a national dialogue. I remember speaking with you last time. You said you're not attending the national dialogue because, one, you were not consulted. Two, it's not inclusive. So if the president is offering an opportunity for people to dialogue and sit down, and you're not part of it, how is there going to be a solution to the conflict?
What kind of dialogue is that? If President Salva is offering, he's the one who has become the Lord, the givers and the takers. Why is he firing people and arresting people like those of Malum? When we are talking about the dialogue, people are being killed in Yei. Is it, Madam Rebecca, do I have any gun that I'm killing people? I'm not fighting anybody. I want peace for my people in South Sudan. Why my people are continuing to fight? Why are they dying? We are talking about dialogue, which is not inclusive. And then you are arresting others, and you say that you want peace. What are we going to dialogue about? While you are locking other people up, and you are saying that you are talking about dialogue. You are dialoguing with who? This thing, as I said, and I still stand for that, is not inclusive. The IO is not there, and those who are carrying guns are not included. And they say that they don't want them. Then what kind of dialogue are we doing in South Sudan? If you are a leader, you are a leader for who? You are a leader for those people who do not like you. You are a leader for those who like you. And those who do not like you, you should always appeal and see them so that you bring them on your side.
I have been speaking to you since 2013 until today. I have never heard
yes,
you.
John.
I've never heard your voice very angry like today. You sound a little bit annoyed. Is there a reason why you are annoyed?
John, I'm very annoyed because the way our people are dying. I'm telling you, if you go now, the northern Baragazal and you go to forest state of Baragazal are all in Darfur. Nobody talk about the famine and the hunger that they are in. People are talking about what is happening in Upper Nile where the war was. And nobody's even talking about the Equatoria. It's international. We get the figures and the people who are dying with hunger from the UN, from the international community. But us, ourselves, we are not talking about the hunger and the famine that we have. In Baragazal, forest state, people are hungry. People are going to Darfur. And you know the situation in Darfur cannot obtain the people in that big population, the big population of South Sudan going to that area. Nobody's talking about them, and they are dying. How can I not be angry? And there is no voice of the government. People are going to talk just few things, and then the money is being used by people flying from this place to another place. And people are hungry. People are dying. That's why I'm angry.
That's Rebecca Nyandeng, widow of South Sudan's founding father, John Garang. She was speaking to me from Nairobi earlier today. As the world marks the International Day of UN Peacekeepers, a UN official in Imatong State Capital Torit is calling on authorities to arrest government and armed opposition forces who destroyed schools, health facilities and other infrastructure. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Torit.
Health facilities in Moli, Pageri and Pajok of Imatong Estate have either been looted or destroyed by both government forces and armed opposition since the conflict spread to these areas about a year ago, according to local officials and a UN representative. Mary Cummins, a field officer in Torit with the United Nations mission in South Sudan, says unmiss patrol teams have seen firsthand how the warring parties have destroyed various facilities that provided health and educational services to citizens. Cummins is calling on authorities to protect government buildings and to arrest soldiers who attacked healthcare clinics and schools.
We hope that there will be accountability for the attacks on educational facilities and healthcare facilities and personnel. These are government and community-owned buildings used by everyone. They are a part of a community's human rights. The government has a duty to prevent forced displacement and to pursue durable solutions for refugees and internally displaced persons so that they can return to their homes in the state knowing that their safety and security is assured.
According to a resident who prefers not to be mentioned for safety reasons, it is not uncommon to see looted items being sold in the markets by men in uniform. Charles Okulu is chairperson of the Imatong Estate Civil Society Network. He says South Sudan's warring parties have deliberately attacked schools and health clinics.
This building, whether being the schools, whether being the hospital, the health unit has been destroyed, has been looted. This property is not the property of an individual. It is the property that belongs to the government. It is the property that belongs to the community. it promotes the welfare of the community has been destroyed during this conflict.
Both the government and the armed opposition have repeatedly denied their forces have destroyed or looted schools or healthcare facilities. Cummins says now that President Salva Kiir has declared a unilateral ceasefire, the government must redouble its effort to protect civilians in their villages so they can till the land and produce food for their families.
The farmers need to know they will be safe when they go to work in their fields and look after their livestock. I appeal to everybody, whether in government or in opposition, in civil society, to make a real effort in reconciling and healing.
Cummins says, regardless of your ethnicity, it is only by living in peaceful coexistence with each other and with your neighboring communities that peace can take root and grow. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
Local aid workers are often on the front lines of South Sudan's conflict, dispensing aid to tens of thousands of displaced people in IDP camps who fled their homes when violence erupted. Their knowledge of the history and geography of the country can be crucial for carrying out life-saving work. The International Insurance Agency called Clements says South Sudan is the third on their list for the highest number of incidents reported after Afghanistan and Sudan. And in recent years, they have seen a demand from local non-governmental organizations for health care, kidnap ransom and life-saving insurance for local staff. Ayan Bior has more for VOA from Washington.
2016 was a deadly year for aid workers in South Sudan's humanitarian field. The UN OCHA reports at least 80 aid workers have been killed in the country since December 2013, including six people this year. Smita Bargav, Vice President of Programs and Special Risk for Clements, says as violence increases in countries like South Sudan, so does the demand for insurance for local employees of NGOs.
More and more NGOs are realizing that they do need to offer at least some comparable level of coverage to these local nationals, because their own countries may not have much of a social security, welfare, or a medical system. So that realization has, over the years, resulted in basic benefits being purchased by NGOs, especially for local nationals.
Six aid workers for GRETA, which stands for Grassroots Empowerment and Development Organization, were killed in a convoy traveling to Bibor in March in what was called the single most deadly attack on aid workers since fighting began in late 2013. In March, Samaritan's Purse confirmed that some of their South Sudanese staff in the Mayandit area of South Sudan were detained by armed personnel. They were detained for 4 days before being released. Bargov says in the past 7 years, NGOs, in an effort to minimize losses, have decided to provide health insurance as well as kidnapping and ransom insurance for local staff in places like South Sudan, Sudan, and Afghanistan, as well as other conflict-affected countries, because locals can often be more vulnerable to harassment or attacks than outside NGO staff.
What we see this is driven by is first a series of losses. The model of NGOs is to use a lot of local nationals, and that has been, the model for many years now. And as they keep increasing the number of local nationals, those local nationals are put in the line of fire a lot more than the expats are. So that has resulted in a lot of fatalities, injuries, and various types of losses.
Bargov says more NGOs are looking to provide standardized benefits to their local staff members to meet the growing needs of the local staff working in hostile areas, but also to avoid appearing discriminatory against local staff.
And I keep repeating some level of benefits because they're still not there in providing absolutely the same benefit. For example, typical policies, insurance policies that NGOs will provide to local nationals, and this is again not a standard between all NGOs, but the typical policies are personal accident, which is death, accidental death and dismemberment and permanent total disability to the local staff. They may offer life insurance, which is death due to any causes.
Bargov says availability of insurance depends on the size of the NGO, as well as the location of local and international staff. Bhargav says while she prefers not to get into specifics about the amount of insurance that is being offered, she says there certainly is an upward trend on providing insurance to local employees of NGOs operating in places like South Sudan. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudanese who fled to northern Uganda say their children should be in school. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you think the current younger generation is disrespectful? Why or why not?
I don't think they are disrespectful. I think we haven't taught them general cultural behavior patterns for the African. We have tended to bring them up more as Western people. So we haven't passed on the African way of respect.
Not all, yeah. Maybe those who have been raised properly in good homes. But I also think the result of this disrespect and bad behavior is the breakage of homes.
I think they are disrespectful because looking at the olden times, people respected culture. People respected elderly people. But today, they don't think about whether this person is older than me or not.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. South Sudanese refugees at Oshia Camp in Uganda's Arua district say many of their children are not in school, but they have found a way to make sure their children attend some school without the help of camp officials. Simon Peter Apiku has this report from Arua district in Uganda's northern region.
Juma William, a refugee at the Otea camp from Yei River State, says when parents realized that the camp, which hosts nearly 10,000 refugees, had only one primary school that could not accommodate all their children, they decided to establish a community school on their own. William says the refugees constructed classrooms and recruited teachers themselves.
The teachers are just volunteering. They are not paid, so which we don't know what will happen next. But otherwise, they are struggling.
William, a certified South Sudanese teacher and volunteer at the community school, says the school depends on the goodwill of fellow refugees to ensure that children who would otherwise be out of school receive an education.
You know, in the community, like when you have a counter book, you give for the teachers to use for preparation. There are some of the refugees who are in the town, they could send some pieces of chalks. That is the only thing they are getting. But otherwise, proper support to them is not there.
The problem, says Kerikumba Tabia, a refugee from Western Equatorial State, is that the settlement has only one primary school for thousands of students at Ochea camp, so not all children get an opportunity to enroll.
With the influx of refugees here, all the refugees' children have to go to that school, and that school is not enough to accommodate the population.
William says Ochea Primary School was so overcrowded that an average class contained 150 pupils.
You cannot manage to deliver the right services to the child. Following up the slow learners, individual differences becomes difficult with all this number of learners in the class.
Viola Nancy, a pupil at Ochea Primary, says learning at an extremely overcrowded school is not just difficult but uncomfortable.
The class, even if you're sitting, the desk is too small, and even if you want to write, you're not able to write. In one bench, people are sitting more than six.
Tabia says there is no secondary school within walking distance of the camp, which has forced hundreds, if not thousands, of older students to remain at home. As a result, she says, some parents are forced to relocate their children to a different settlement, but not all parents can do that.
It is not easy for parents, I'm talking as a parent now, to afford to build a tuku for a child to shift from here to stay in Wanyagi in order to get access to education. Secondly, you pay school fees. Thirdly, you feed this kid when you are jobless, you are idle.
South Sudanese refugees at the Ochea camp say they understand the importance of educating their children, and that's why even with little or no outside support, their community is finding a way to keep their children in classrooms. For VOA News, I'm Simon Peter Pico, in Kampala.
Still on children, other children are not so lucky. South Sudanese parents in a camp at the Bidibidi refugee settlement in Uganda's West Nile region say their children are sitting idle most of the time and they have little hope for the future. The parents say some of the children are turning to alcohol and other forms of drug abuse to escape reality. Tito Justin visited Bidibidi refugee settlement camp recently and filed this report for VOA from Juba.
Hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese fled to Uganda when fighting spread to Lanya, Yei, and Morobo counties of Yei River State last year. A majority of those fleeing the violence in South Sudan are seeking refuge in several camps within the Bidibidi refugee settlement, including Yangani. But many South Sudanese youth who were studying back home are unable to continue their education because there is no secondary school in Yangani. The nearest school is in Yoyo Camp, a two-hour walk from Yangani Camp. 19-year-old Robert Bida was in Senior 3 when he fled Yei River State's Lanya County after fighting broke out in Lanya last year. Bida says he fled to Bidibidi refugee settlement with the hope of continuing his secondary education.
Since we come, there's not something like a school, and really, I see the life is very difficult. It's very difficult because suppose we come here because of school, but no school, and I see the life is difficult.
Bida says for the past year, he spent most of his time doing nothing or did a bit of menial work like cleaning the compound. 17-year-old John Alafi would have been taking his university entry examinations this year back in South Sudan. Alafi says now that he is staying at Yangani Camp, his hopes of receiving an education are fading fast.
I learned field well because still I have interest to join school. So that's why I said that it's better to UN also to help us to build schools. I want to be in school, so there's no way. If I build in school, I know my future will be better.
18-year-old Joseph Taban also fled Yei River State when he was in Senior 3. Taban keeps himself busy at the camp by playing football with friends. He says being out of school makes him feel like he is wandering in the darkness. He admits that some of his friends have resorted to taking drugs to deal with their frustration.
It is not good to stay with that because many youths have begun eating gomba, chewing maringis, drinking alcohol because there's nothing to do. So it will be fine if they open school so that it makes us busy. If there's time, I just go and play football.
Jimmy Kemis is a father of seven children who fled to Uganda's Bidibidi refugee settlement hoping to enroll his children in school. But Kemis says there are not enough schools for the refugee children, leaving too many of them with nothing to do.
We found that there's no secondary school on ground. Most of our children now resolve just to eat these marungis because there's no school. They are frustrated. They don't know what to do. We are told by UN Sara that the school is in Yoyo. They have to go to that far. So with that, they are just stranded. They can't do anything.
Kemis is appealing to aid agencies to build schools so South Sudanese youth can get an education.
Without education, which means our future will not go far and our future is blind. We can't have anything good for the country. We have a belief and we have a hope that one day we'll go back to our country. But now minus education to our children is going to be difficult.
Bidibidi's Yangani camp hosts about 26,000 South Sudanese refugees, many of them women and children of school age. The camp has only one primary school, and in that school, there are roughly 750 pupils per class. Uganda's officials could not be reached for comment, but said last year that they planned to build more schools in the overcrowded Bidibidi refugee settlement. That has yet to happen. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Kenya, where the official campaign period has begun as the electoral body clears candidates to run for the presidency. Mohammed Yusuf reports for VOA the commission is calling on the candidates to maintain peace during the August polls.
Kenya's presidential campaign has begun with 70 days to the August elections. So far, the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission has cleared seven candidates and rejected three because of logistical issues. Addressing Jubilee Party supporters Monday in Nairobi, Deputy President William Ruto said he and the President will make a re-election bid.
Munajua Uhuru Kenyatta leo
anaenda kupatiana.
As you are aware, today President Uhuru Kenyatta is going to present his papers to the IEBC, given to him by Jubilee Party, so that he can compete for the presidency on August 8th. And we thank you for coming to escort him to the commission, he said. Kenyatta, who is seeking a second term, was the seventh candidate cleared by the IEBC. The main opposition coalition led by former Prime Minister Raila Odinga was one of the presidential hopefuls to be cleared Sunday. Odinga, running for president for the fourth time, is expected to be Kenyatta's main challenger. Electoral Commission Chairman Wafula Chebukati warned leaders against incitement.
You have signed the code of conduct, both as political parties, your respective political parties, as well as now as candidates. And as a commission, we shall not hesitate to take an action if you breach that code of conduct. We want this country to be peaceful before, during and after this election.
The opposition agreed to hold a peaceful campaign. Odinga called on the commission to deliver an election that represents the will of the people.
IEBC must live up to its billing, which is to not only deliver a free and fair, but to ensure that those elections are truly free and fair.
Kenya is still haunted by the 2007 presidential election, won by Mwai Kibaki in a hotly disputed vote. Post-election violence killed more than 1,100 people and forced the top parties into power-sharing agreement. Kenyatta's election in 2013 was peaceful, but was marred by accusations that he and Ruto had helped to organise the 2007 violence. The International Criminal Court eventually dropped charges of crimes against humanity for both men, citing a lack of evidence. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Rebecca Nyandeng is calling on South Sudan army soldiers to stop fighting militias, civilians, and each other. The widow of the founding father of South Sudan, John Garang, says the conflict has affected half of South Sudan's population. She says the fighting benefits one person in particular, President Salva Kiir. She tells this program that if soldiers put down their arms, President Kiir will not be able to stay in power. As the world marks UN Peacekeepers Day, a UN official in Tourist is calling on authorities to arrest both government and armed opposition forces who have destroyed schools, health facilities, and other community buildings. Health facilities in Mali, Pajeri, and Parjok of Imatong State have either been looted or destroyed by government forces and armed opposition since the conflict spread to those areas about a year ago. And finally, local aid workers are often in the middle of South Sudan's conflict zones. Their knowledge of the country can be crucial for carrying out life-saving work by international NGOs. The International Insurance Agency, Clements, ranks South Sudan third on their list for highest number of incidents reported. In recent years, they began offering NGOs insurance for local staff, including health care. That's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Sura Yako by Sauti Sol. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could be here. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Nafanya vituko kama chizi, kukupenda sitasizi, sura yako mzuri mama.